And it is a big country. Is it big enough to hide another hominid species right there in the woods that connect to the parks and the golf courses and the getaways of our lives? Is it big enough that after all of these years, we still don't actually have one, just evidence of Sasquatch? You heard a call last hour in which someone claimed to have just seen one in Mississippi within the last hour. You heard the stories of Pennsylvania. You heard about Florida. It seems like the story never gets old and the trail never gets cold in the great Northwest. But where does legend meet science? We'll talk about it with someone who knows, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Jeff Meldrum, this is like my favorite book so far of the holiday season. This is great gift giving here.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
The topic's not only cool, but you've got the props to talk about it, too. Associate Professor of Anatomy and Anthropology at Idaho State University, affiliate curator of the Idaho Museum of Natural History, PhD in Anatomical Sciences, an emphasis on physical anthropology from SUNY at Stony Brook. You write all sorts of books about the emergence of modern human walking, about locomotion, bipedal locomotion, and you have the largest collection of Sasquatch footprint casts and photographs, and conducted collaborative fieldwork throughout the Pacific Northwest and Intermountain West. If this isn't a great coast-to-coast interview, it's all my fault, because you rock.
Well, thanks.
And I just saw you on the History Channel, too, right? They have this. Is it a version of this book that they use on the History Channel?
Well, the book actually was originally a companion volume to an episode of the History Channel called Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. It grew into a much larger project than just a simple transcription of the program, and I ended up incorporating a great deal of my own personal research and experiences and additional collaborations and conversations with other experts into the book than could understandably be contained in a 50-minute documentary. So it's greatly expanded. The more recent episode that you saw on the History Channel was a new episode, or a new series, rather, an episode in a series, also produced by Doug Hychek, who produced Sasquatch Legend Meets Science for History Channel. And one of the episodes that has aired here recently featured some very interesting events that occurred up in northern Ontario.
Yeah.
And, we'll talk about those.
Definitely want to get into that. Let me start, though, with a call we took last half hour when we were doing open lines, a guy down in Mississippi who said that he had just recently seen a Bigfoot. I don't know in the end whether he convinced me of that, but two things he said stuck out at me funny, and I just want you to comment on them. First of all, Sasquatch sighting in Mississippi. And second of all, that he referred to, he went and got holy water. He identified himself as a priest, and he said he went to go get holy water because he seemed to speak of it as well known that Sasquatch are demonic beasts. And I've never heard that as part of the legend of Sasquatch, that they are somehow agents of Satan. Where are you with that?
Well, that from a scientific perspective, that would be difficult to comment on that. Every individual interprets their experiences from a different frame of reference, and so for some individuals, it might take on that quality or fill that niche
expectation. No, but he seemed to indicate like that was like well-known part of the legend of Sasquatch, that somehow being demonic was something that had been said about Sasquatch before, and he was merely buying into it. I've never heard anybody say that about Bigfoot.
No, I have. Well, you know, sometimes they've been called mountain devils.
Okay.
That type of thing. Mount Diablo in Northern California, supposedly named for the hairy wild men, the monsters that inhabit that mountain. I mean, there's that connection. People have, in early times, have sometimes made that connection. But again, that I think is just part of the folklore aspect. I'm quite certain that we're dealing here with a a biological species. I mean, and that's the basis of the book, is simply, is there a biological species behind the legend of Sasquatch?
Yeah. Well, and let me just say, if it's an agent of Satan, it's really bad at its job, because it really it tends to really not get involved in human life.
Exactly.
So I don't know. Satan picked a loser, I think, by that one. If that's so, and even out in the woods, it tends to shy away from humans, right? I mean, there really aren't like Sasquatch eating human stories.
Oh, of course not. Yeah, that's and had there been, or if there were, then it would be right up there with grizzly bears and mountain lions, and it would most certainly be hunted down to the brink of extinction, because perceived as a threat to humanity. But no, it seems all indications are that they are extremely elusive and evasive of human contact as much as possible. And, you know, they certainly show some curiosity about human activity, and reports of them peering into windows or approaching camps and rifling through belongings and so forth. But I think that comes also not unexpectedly with an animal of some higher intelligence than your average bear, and is again consistent with the profile of a large great ape.
Yeah, I mean grizzlies have more of a reputation of coming after, you know, beer and human women more than Sasquatch. Right? I mean, it's sure. Right. I mean, there are more stories of grizzlies breaking into cabins and so what is it about that you think about the Sasquatch that in your research would indicate its personality is to not make contact with us or to not break into cabins and take food? I mean, if it's as large a beast as it is and would require as many calories as it must, why is it only bears that have this often, you know, sort of violent contact with humans?
Well, there certainly are reports or indications of food being an attractive element in an encounter story, but as was said, I don't think that you know, their success in remaining elusive has been that shine away from humans. As you pointed out, they don't pose a great figure as a demonic you know, character, because most of the encounters are extremely mundane. Witness sees Sasquatch, Sasquatch sees witness, and they both go in opposite directions. And that's about the extent of it in the vast majority of the instances. But certainly there are reports of, you know, of Sasquatch stealing dressed out deer. There are reports of them rifling through backpacks and, you know, pilfering items that way, and obviously they often display curiosity about human activity. We get reports of rock throwing. I mean, this is one of the things that occurred to us up in northern Ontario that suggested some form of interaction and that was different, atypical of a bear encounter.
Right,
but I, as I said, I think there's this, I suspect, and this is speculation on my part, that there's this tug of war that goes on with an animal of that intelligence, not an extraordinary intelligence, but a higher primate, that on the one hand they recognize the risks involved, I mean, from an instinctual, but perhaps even up to a cognitive level of recognition, but on the other hand, because of that intelligence, it makes them very curious about things that are different or unusual in their environment. And a human camp or a brightly lit cabin at night or those types of things would perhaps draw their attention, and their curiosity may win out over their reticence to risk contact with human individuals.
You're talking about higher level of primate. Is it high enough of a level of primate to suggest that cryptozoological is inaccurate to categorize the Sasquatch?
I don't think so, because, you know, and we have this conversation frequently with people who wonder about the level of intelligence or the degree of humanity, and again, only having existing fossil record and historical record of the human tenure on this planet, we can we can at least speculate based on that. As soon as the genus Homo appeared in the fossil record, it was also accompanied with an archaeological record. That means there was material cultural elements that were associated with the presence of that species. So stone tools, and then clothing, and fire control, and home bases, and art objects, and tools, and so on and so on. And yet, when you consider the Sasquatch reports, they seem to be uniformly devoid of any type of material culture. As I when I'm talking to public audiences, I sometimes jokingly refer to George Carlin's routine of stuff. You know, people have stuff, and he makes pokes a lot of fun at the various unusual behaviors that we have associated with our own stuff. And yet, Bigfoot doesn't seem to have any stuff. It's devoid of all of that. And so, if it is a type of a primitive human, then it's got to be something very, very different than what we would typically associate with human behavior and human activities. I mean, that's not beyond the realm of possibility, but I don't see any evidence so far to, at least I've not experienced anything personally or encountered firsthand those who have, that would suggest that hypothesis should be entertained at this point.
Granted, I've never seen and or heard of a Bigfoot wearing pants or anything like that, but can we definitively know that they aren't a collector of stuff until we find, absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt, a Bigfoot lair, and know for sure that a Bigfoot was, say, you know, staying in this cave for a period of time, to know whether or not there aren't some things, some maybe even primitive, you know, examples of its nascent, you know, humanity or something, that would prove that it is a collector, at least in a small way, of stuff, perhaps. Like a dog is often a collector of stuff. My dog has three or four things which are his, and he doesn't like other people to touch it.
Exactly. Well, your point is very accurate. I mean, obviously, dealing with a subject like this, where in many instances we have to rely on speculation or extrapolation from the data that we do have in the form of anecdotal reports and sightings and footprint finds and hair and so forth, the types of data that we have at hand at the moment that bear on the question. Of course, we're very limited, but you hit on a very important point that in many behaviors and many aspects of those things that we hold near and dear as uniquely human characteristics that seem to distinguish us from the animal kingdom, they are often differences of degree and not differences of kind.
Right.
So, yes, chimpanzees have stone anvils and hammer stones that they sequester and they use, it appears, for generation after generation,
right.
And so on. So, in that context, I think that there probably are examples. I mean, people have described Sasquatch opportunistically brandishing sticks or throwing rocks or other types of things that really would fit very comfortably into the sort of paradigm of ape behavior and modification, manipulation of their environment.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Sasquatch Legend Meets Science is the book, and it's going to be a great conversation tonight. And I know we'll get into more of what's in the book, but let's then also return to what we said. We mentioned some of these hot stories that are out now post-publication. So you have the kind of the sighting going on in Florida. I mean, it seems much more likely that's going to be some sort of escaped primate that's up in the trees. But people were talking about as being a skunk ape, and I'll let you talk about that. But also this video that was captured, or these images taken from Pennsylvania, and then the one from Ontario. Any of these stories catch your eye more than the other?
Well, The one from Pennsylvania, the Jacobs photos, I guess you're referring to, was an intriguing one, and I don't know that it has been resolved 100% in my mind. I have to say, I certainly in discussing it in one interview, I tried to look at both possibilities. The more conservative possibilities were it was a bear on the one hand versus it was a quite frankly, a chimpanzee is one of my first reactions upon seeing that image was that it did bear a striking resemblance to chimpanzee posture and anatomy, which I'm somewhat familiar with. But there were other aspects that pointed towards bear. For example, the configuration of the shoulder joint. If you look carefully at one of those pictures, the one where it's more sprawled in its posture.
Right.
The shoulder blades actually kind of jut up above the back line, the line of the back, and they're very vertical. They're lined with the upper arm, the humerus of the forelimb, and the shape and orientation of the pelvis is remarkably more like a quadruped than it is, and more like a bear than it is like a chimpanzee, which has very distinctive broad. Very tall and very broad and side-to-side oriented blades of the pelvis in the lower back, projecting up into the lower back. So, and unfortunately, my interview was a little bit skewed in the way it was edited and presented.
Really?
What did they
make you say?
Well, they didn't make me say anything, but there was a heavy emphasis on the comments and the discussions about the possibilities of a juvenile Sasquatch or an ape, as opposed to those observations that tended to point towards a bear. I think that given all the circumstances, that we have to use a lot of caution. I mean, it's reported that there are 7 additional photos that have never been released yet, and one has to ask, well, why not? You know,
why
what
not?
Was the sequence and so forth?
Does it look distinctly more bear-like in other photos, and therefore they withdraw those? Yeah, in fact, though, it would have had to have been kind of a bear with a hair problem, right? I mean, so some sort of skin condition.
Well, that's been suggested that it may have been suffering from mange. And also there's the fact that it was shot in IR, and sometimes. When you shoot things like that, you don't get an image that is quite what one would expect from just a regular optical photograph with visible light. And I frankly have not looked at comparable photographs enough in that medium to be able to say that with any authority. But I can't help but wonder if something taken with an IR might have, especially when the hair is a little bit sparse to begin with, might exaggerate that sparsity because it's the heat of the body that the camera is seeing rather than the surface itself.
But there was a certain irony to that because we're talking about the same Jacobs photos from the Pennsylvania possible sighting of Bigfoot, of a juvenile Bigfoot. Hairlessness is not a characteristic that's associated with a Bigfoot, and yet its hairlessness is what gave it most the impression of being a hominid.
Right.
So it's kind of a contradiction. It looked more human-like, it looked less bear-like because it was without hair, but that's nothing that's ever been some way that somebody described a Bigfoot.
True. I mean, a Bigfoot, the hair on Bigfoot is often described as hair-like as opposed to fur-like, being that if indeed it is a primate, it doesn't have that dual coat of fur that consists of this under fur and that's finer and much denser, and then the coarser guard hairs that are longer. Primate hair is kind of a modified type of a guard hair. And so, I mean, the sparsity by comparison to, say, the image, the appearance of the two bear cubs in the accompanying photo in that set, that does give it a bit more of an ape-like appearance. I mean, in other words, if that were a chimpanzee, you would see much more of the actual skin surface.
All right, then hang on to that thought, and we'll come right back. Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, Dr. Jeff Meldrum on the Ontario sighting, next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jeff Meldrum is a professor in your father of six. Is that right, Jeff?
That's correct.
How many of those boys are teenagers?
Well, the oldest is 24. The youngest is 7.
Okay. My point is that you have obviously guys in your house that eat like a Sasquatch.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So you no wonder you have an affinity toward that beast. So with this conversation, we're just talking there at the bottom of the hour about the Pennsylvania stories. Let's put that aside, still unresolved, and we're waiting for more of those images that were captured with the infrared to be released. Any comment you want to make about the Florida story or on back onto the Ontario reports?
Well, as far as Florida, you'll have to bring me up to speed because I'm not aware of anything at the moment that has happened there recently of note.
A creature was seen climbing in and out of trees in an area where there were no reports of escaped primates. It was considered large and not chimpanzee-like, which led some people to say orangutan. It had a coloring like an orangutan, but nobody got enough of a look at it. They put out food. I think it was donuts and, I don't know, Slim Jims or something at the bottom of this tree where they had seen it. And in the morning, the food was gone and the beast was gone too. So no one's gotten close. And tree climbing, is that considered sort of a Sasquatch-like behavior?
Well, there have been reports and some quite credible and interesting ones. One that came to mind was, as you mentioned, that in Oregon, just south of Mount Hood on the highway there, there was a report of a Sasquatch that leapt from a tree onto the side of the road and was witnessed by a number of vehicles full of people going in both directions. They certainly would have the wherewithal to climb. Their size, though, would restrict their proclivity to climb. The larger the animal, the more risky is climbing behaviors, because a fall can be life-threatening when you reach a certain point and a certain height. And there's not really the motivation, I wouldn't think, because most of the food items that they would be after would be in the understory or elsewhere. Coniferous forests don't have a very productive canopy as far as edibles for a large omnivore, which is one of the ways I think the Sasquatch sort of fit into the niche as a large terrestrial biped. There isn't the demand for arboreality as you would have in, a tropical environment where most of the fruits are up in the canopy. I mean, that's the very reason primates have evolved as an arboreal order of mammals.
Well, we don't climb trees only for food. Could it be that, and would you consider that a Bigfoot might be climbing a tree for a different purpose altogether, perhaps to send his scent out over a larger area, or if it was a regular behavior to orient himself or herself to the environment?
Certainly, that would be a possibility as well, and often, or to hide. Just as hunters use tree stands, because many animals don't often look up in that direction for possible threats. That could be one explanation as well.
Right, yeah. To jump onto a passing deer, perhaps.
No, that very possibly, yeah.
And that brings us back to a question about range, though, in the South. We know about the Northwest, and we hear about other sightings going on in the upper part of the United States. What about Sasquatch sightings in other places around the U.S.?
Right. Well, I have to acknowledge that I've only recently had the wherewithal to devote a little bit of time to look into that that aspect of the phenomenon, the eastern and southern manifestations. And prior to just a couple of years ago, I had very little exposure. There's two things I think to keep in mind. One is the habitat. I mean, is there sufficient resources? A good rule of thumb that you can use, I think, as a starting point is the habitat rich enough to support other large omnivores like black bear? So wherever black bear can make a living, I would think there'd be at least the potential for another large omnivore to also eke out an existence from the resources that are there. But then there's also the population densities. And, of course, we think of much, much higher population densities in the eastern and southern United States, but upon closer examination, much of that population is often concentrated in urban centers and or along coastlines or riverways, and much of the hill country, much of the river bottoms, the backwoods are quite sparsely populated and infrequented by regular human activity. So even in places where we think that people are everywhere and trampling over every square inch, that's often not the case. So,
well, not to mention the fact that, I mean, part of this might have to do with the modus operandi of the bear hunter versus the Sasquatch hunter, in that bears, unless I'm wrong on this, tend to be more opportunistic about food. They're foragers. They fish, obviously, but even there, it's not like they set up some sort of elaborate kind of fishing method. Whereas, would a Sasquatch be the same type of feeder as an omnivore, or would it be more inclined to be more active in the way in which it acquires, say, meat protein? I mean, would it thrive in an area like, say, Appalachia, where there are three times the number of deer there today than there were 100 years ago?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think, your point is a good one, that we shouldn't just equate two species with a simplistic label of omnivore. There are different ways of being an omnivore. And one of the things about Sasquatch, based on the descriptions of eyewitnesses of their anatomy and their shape and proportions and so forth, but also if we can for a moment just assume that the most likely ancestral candidate for Sasquatch is something like Gigantopithecus. Gigantopithecus has these extremely robust, heavy jaws and large molars, a large dentition overall, with very, very thick molar enamel. So the chewing apparatus of this large terrestrial ape is contrasts considerably with that of a bear, which has a different strategy altogether. So even though their diet is omnivorous in that it contains varieties of plants and animal resources, the way in which those are harvested and processed and the emphasis that is placed on various types of food sources would be very different between these two species. Gigantopithecus, with its very large size, with its very thick molar enamel and so forth, would be able to process much coarser, much harder items than would a bear. And given an ape's physiology, would theoretically be able to digest potentially resources that might be unavailable or inaccessible to a bear because of slow gut passage time and the ability to detoxify secondary compounds in leaves and so forth. An interesting example, up in the Seattle area, the Native Americans there have always held that Sasquatch eat alder leaves. Well, bears don't eat alder leaves, but alder leaves are extremely prolific and widely distributed along the waterways and so forth. And so if, you know, the ability to digest a food item like alder leaves, for example, with its secondary compounds and types of carbohydrates and so forth, if those were accessible, there's a whole supply of food, a whole resource that opens up that would be available to a large primate as opposed to a large bear.
Well, if you're going to go with the skull models you have of Gigantopithecus, I always have to make sure I get that in there. Can't get all the syllables right. And or any of these models that we might have for Bigfoot, that huge jawline and the muscle structure would seem to imply not just the need to grind leaves, but also, say, to crack bones, wouldn't it? I mean, wouldn't it imply that kind of...
That would be very possible, too, yes, certainly. And, yeah. There are lots of reports of... that fits the profile very consistently, that large mammals, as well as small mammals and fish, are all taken by this animal as well.
The book is Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. I think your discussion about food brings us right into the chapter on scat. So, I mean, you have to, we consider, you know, how much it must consume, so you would think Bigfoot scat or Sasquatch, I guess would be a good way. Sasquatch. You would find that around a lot, and yet, how many examples really do exist of what you think or what researchers might be investigating as being likely droppings from a Bigfoot?
Well, not a whole lot. I mean, again, the challenge that's faced there is that we are dealing with an omnivore, and so omnivores have scat that varies in consistency and appearance depending on what was on the menu in the preceding days. And since omnivores eat a large variety of food items, then there's the consistency and appearance of their scat is going to change. Bears are the prime example of this. And then distinguishing a scat pile from a Sasquatch, scat piles from either bear or Sasquatch becomes even another challenge, because what's the distinctive appearance or shape or if the consistency and content isn't necessarily going to distinguish those very readily. But the other thing to bear in mind is that the rarity of this species, that the numbers that are out there, which must be very, very low, otherwise, encounters and as you point out, signs of their foraging, of their eating and defecating would be much more obvious, but they're not. We don't know how a Sasquatch defecates. I mean, there's been scat piles that have been attributed to them and have produced some interesting results in the form of unusual parasites or very finely masticated food items. But we don't know. They could bury their scat in a cat-like fashion. They could perform coprophagy, where they consume some of their scat again if they're eating a very high fiber diet at that particular time.
Perhaps that's why they're climbing trees.
Well, that's right.
Maybe they're just go up there.
Yeah, who knows?
Look out below.
Well, I mean, you say that, but it's kind of funny. On one of our outings in the Blue Mountains outside of Walla Walla, there was an area where there was a tree, a very large tree, in a spot where sightings had occurred. And as we were scouting around looking for some sign, there was obvious wear on some of the lower branches of this tree, where something had rubbed against these branches quite frequently, it would seem. And so I thought, well, let's take a look up there. And so we cluttered on up there, and this was a very large ponderosa pine, as I recall, and which are good climbing trees. And right up in the top, I mean, I was up probably about 35 feet. The crown had been struck by lightning or something, but the crown was very misshapen, and the tree had kind of widened out up there. And there was a nice little spot. And from that spot, you had a fantastic vantage point of the surrounding valley. And lo and behold, right smack in the middle was the scat pile.
Hello.
Its dimensions, and we did collect it, but its dimensions and its appearance weren't excessive in dimension or quality or quantity, rather, excuse me. But I was quite impressed by that fact that there was some animal that was using that tree and that little perch, almost a nest-like little perch, naturally up there with the gnarly branches and widened out, flattened crown, open crown of this tree as a resting point or a vantage point, and at
or a latrine.
Latrine had relieved itself up there.
That's very sort of the Sasquatch equivalent of bringing a newspaper or something.
There you go. Yeah.
But in the book, maybe I didn't finish this chapter, but going back to the idea of finding Sasquatch somewhere, that the weren't you testing some in a lab and trying to determine whether or not it could have been? And is there such a thing as a DNA strain that would be excreted with this that would allow you to be able to trace its species of origin?
Excuse me. Well, yes. Now, since my involvement, I have not had opportunity to examine scat that I was confident enough that there was a good chance that this might be associated with Sasquatch activity to ask someone to do an analysis. There have been reported analyses that I make mention of in the book. The most interesting incident that we had, that I had some involvement with, there was a piece of scat that was turned over from a witness, and it was given to my colleague, John Myanzinski. And he had been interacting with a scat dog handler from Colorado. These dogs are trained to locate, particular type of scat. And they're also used in search and – these dogs were used in search and rescue efforts. So very, very well-trained and very capable and skilled dogs. She took a piece of the scat and hid it out in her backyard, and then set the dog, her dog, to task. This was an exercise she often would do to keep the dog skills honed. And sure enough, it went scouting about and came upon that scat, at which point it just dropped to its belly, its ears down, its tail down. She was so impressed by this, because she had never seen her dog react this way before, that she called her partner, and he brought his dog over. And as it discovered the scat, it reacted in exactly the same way. Now, this raises all kinds of interesting curiosities and questions, because what is it in the scat? This scat was very dried and desiccated. It was not of real exceptional dimension, and one of the interesting characteristics, it was studded with black ant carapaces. Whatever it was had been eating a lot of black ants. Many of its body parts their body parts had passed through incompletely digested, but it was at this point was no longer useful for DNA analysis. DNA, as you point out, can be retrieved from scat, from fresh scat, because some of the cells, the mucosal lining of the intestine, will be sort of sloughed off and pass with the voided scat. But if not preserved rather promptly, the bacterial action, the bacteria, are very plentiful in the scat, will very quickly degrade and digest away that remaining cellular material and the DNA contained in it. So we have not yet had the opportunity to have had scat analyzed for DNA DNA content, but that certainly is high on our list of objectives to try to employ in the field, along with the potential use of scat dogs in that effort to identify and to locate additional examples of scat, which would potentially yield DNA, would potentially tell us what the animals are eating at that particular time, and therefore, combined with GIS analysis might help us to, with geographic information,
sure,
or coverage maps, might help us to locate what where they are ranging at that particular time period, where certain resources are plentiful and available and desirable at that time.
Well, when you go out in the woods, bring both something to collect it with and perhaps an umbrella until you know exactly what's going on. Sasquatch, legend meets science. Dr. Jeff Meldrum. We'll get down to cases. The Patterson film next on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Meldrum, a professor at Idaho State University. He focuses on vertebrate locomotion. He's an expert on determining the difference in bone and muscle structure in bipeds, and that's part of why he uses legend and science to understand Sasquatch. We'll get to this scientific exploration of the legend of the Patterson film, the Patterson-Gimlin film, coming up next. It's a big part of this book, and it comes down in a different way than you might expect next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, I was very interested in your book on the Patterson film. I had, in fact, when I first got your book, that was the first thing I did. I went to the table of contents to go look that up, because over the years, we've heard several different versions of how it was a hoax. And even recently, I think perhaps even in the same History Channel special that featured some of the interview with you, I thought they went through some of the bone structure and the way that this monster, or you know, image of a monster turned in the Patterson film, and if it was a Bigfoot, then how would it have acted? If it was a human, how would it have gone? And so I thought, well, I wonder what he's got to say about this. And I was kind of surprised by the findings and the way in which you analyzed it, but we'll just start at the beginning. The Patterson film, for people that don't know, the one from, was it 1971 or two?
67.
I'm sorry, 67.
Yeah,
okay.
45 what, this year.
That's right, and Patterson died in like 72 or something like that.
I think so.
Right. And so, in a way, some people said he hoaxed it and didn't tell his partner and took it to his grave. Where are you with all of the discussions of the hoax of the Patterson film?
Well, as you point out, there have been a number of different pretenders rivaling for that apparently coveted slot of being the man in the fursuit. But upon examination, each and every one of those claimants' stories doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And, of course, their explanation, their allegations should be scrutinized, I think, just as rigorously as the claims that the film is authentic. You know, the most recent effort was Bob Hieronymus and Philip Morris, the costume maker, who laid claim, and their claims were documented in Greg Long's book. And upon examination, as I said, they just don't hold up. They don't account for the anatomy, for the dynamics, the kinesiology, all the aspects of the film subject as it's walking across that sandbar on that piece of that clip of film. Many of the skeptics, especially those who don't have the acumen to evaluate the film on its own face, take these very circuitous routes to try to debunk by examining the character, examining the context and circumstances, and those are elements that certainly need to be weighed in the balance. But the absence of a reasonable and a conclusive analysis of the film itself is a glaring gap in any argument against the film.
Well, explain what you think is captured on that film, which leads you to conclude that this is more than likely a real image of a Bigfoot walking across a sandbar.
Right. Well, a starting point for me, and probably the starting point for me, was because of my primary emphasis on the footprint evidence and the story, the tale told by that data set. That's where I started. That's where I began, was looking at the associated footprints that were documented on the sandbar, both by Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin, at the time of the filming, but then were witnessed by multiple other witnesses, Lyle Laverty of Timber Cruiser, who was on the scene within just a couple of days, snapped off some photographs of some of the clear of the footprints, and those, some of those same prints were then further cast by Bob Titmus, who came on the scene sometime later. That documentation is really quite extraordinary. Titmus cast 10 successive footprints, irregardless of their quality, and so we have a very good record of the variation from step to step, the variation in toe position, the expression of that mid-tarsal break that I talk about in the book as well, the other characteristics of the foot that might not have been as apparent and discernible if we only had the single right and the left footprint that were cast by Roger Patterson himself. So it's an exceptional case of documentation of a long line of tracks. And then when combined with the film itself, where one can then also evaluate the kinematics, the movements of the film subject, and even details of the movements of the foot, this is clearly not, and anyone who honestly and objectively examines this film has to account for this. The feet that are evident on that film clip are not simple contrivances of carved wooden feet or some simplistic floppy artificial foot of a simple costume. Even some elaborate costumes that I have seen, the feet often come up very short of the mark. These feet show dynamic features and animation that are consistent with a living, articulated, responsive foot that show points of flexion, that show movement of the toes that are visible. I mean, that are visible in the film itself. Not referring here to the footprints now,
right,
but then which correlate with the footprints very nicely. I mean, one of the things that really struck me upon looking at the film very closely, focusing on the feet, as there are several frames, series of frames that capture individual step cycles, where you can see as the foot swings forward, the toes dorsiflex or point upward just before the foot makes contact, and then they flex back down against the soil, against the sand, and that is something that you're not going to get with a Ray Wallace style carved wooden foot strapped to the bottom of a costume. The animation is just really amazing.
Right. But, okay, and again, I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit because, I'm the dumbest guy I know. But
for the sake of discussion, that's great.
In your chapter, you got all these super brainy people, right, with all these alphabets after their name,
right,
and none of them can agree on what the size of the image is that's in the film. And every one of them has some sort of way of determining the size of the creature as it walks across the frame of the Patterson footage,
right,
but they vary significantly by some cases like 6 inches from one expert opinion to another expert opinion. And it's not just height, but also weight, and the sort of the width of the chest.
Right.
It kind of goes to show that maybe there is not a hard scientific way of judging whether or not that is accurate. If there could be so many smart people that see it so differently.
Well, there's two issues here. I mean, one is does the analysis of the kinematics of the movements and the gait of the individual, is that dependent on a very precise and accurate estimate of the size and mass? And the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, yes, to the degree that you want to judge aspects like pendulum moments of the extremities, how much inertia is there, are there adaptations of the anatomy that one would expect for a certain weight range or mass as opposed to another. And then on the other hand, there are limitations to the ability to accurately reconstruct the size, and those limitations and the resulting variation due to some of those limitations doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a rigorous scientific approach to try to determine that. I mean, we like you say, the estimates, as varied as they as the few might be, are still within about 6 inches of one another. And I don't think the disparity is so large that we should, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
No, but that made me suspicious. And I'm not trying to be too much of a drag on that, because I would love for the Patterson film to be real. Don't get me wrong. But, sure. I mean 6 inches in terms of a tolerance of science, it's got to be ridiculous. I mean, for a creature that isn't that far away from the film, for something that had some sense of perspective, because, and I'll be more specific, if the creature is determined to be 8'3" tall or something, as like the higher end of the estimates went, that really makes you think, well, gosh, there just aren't that many 8-foot people walking around that could get into a bear suit. But if it's more like 6 foot, you know, okay, well, you know, so I guess I think it is significant to think how tall was the actual creature that's seen in the film, because it would lend credence to one argument over another.
That's true. I mean, in the sense of if it were of excessive height, then you're right, because not only would you have to find the guy that big to fill the costume, but you'd have to make a costume that was very customized to that person. Because you're not going to find a costume off the shelf that's made for an 8-foot person. There's not much of a market for that, is there? So
no.
So, but I mean, I'm not aware of any estimates, any reasonable estimates that go up into that range.
Right. I'm just saying that that would be my example of why it's important that. But you had another point you wanted to make. I wanted to hear it.
Well, the range that I'm aware of is, you know, if you take, for example, Grover Krantz's estimate, in which he utilized the foot, the apparent size of the foot seen in the film. And the only criticism I have of that approach is, I mean, we know the scale of the foot, presumably, by the length of the footprints. And so I think what Grover did was take that foot, look for a frame in which the foot was more or less vertical and therefore more aligned and parallel to the focal plane of the film, and therefore a more accurate projection of its length, and then tried to see how many units of that foot length could be would be necessary to account for the height of the film subject. One of the things that I don't know that he really accounted for, took care for, was the fact that the film was quite overexposed. And those areas that were, or not excessively overexposed, but there was an issue of overexposure, which would make those areas that are light or that are more reflective, like the foot in that perspective, a bit washed out, would burn out on the film a little bit, and thereby blur out the edges of the foot. Now, M.K. Davis, for example, has done some real interesting manipulations of those images, and one of the things that he's shared with me is some of his renderings of the foot. You can actually, with manipulation of the image, demonstrate some of that halo effect or that aura effect of the foot. That could account, especially given the scales that we're dealing with, which, in my opinion, is the case, that Grover may have underestimated the height because he was working with an image of a foot that was sort of artificially enlarged by the overexposure, and therefore he would get fewer of those feet into the height of the subject, which would underestimate the height in his case.
Well, there's something wrong about his criteria to begin with. If he assumed some sort of hard and fast ratio between the size of the foot and the likelihood of the size of the beast that would have a foot that size. And I think you would have to have, I would think, 100 Bigfoot to measure in order to come up with any kind of hard and fast criteria on foot to body size ratio.
Well, he wasn't working off of any preconception of such a ratio. He simply, if you look at a still frame from the film,
right,
where the foot is in a more or less vertical posture, then and from the tracks we know that foot is between 14.5 inches and 15 inches. Then if you just take that foot, and as he actually did in his book, You just stack foot lengths up the backside of the subject until you reach the crown of the head.
Right.
Then you have an estimate, a rough estimate in this case, of the minimum height, which he estimated a walking height of about 6.5 feet, as I recall.
Right.
Now,
all right.
I think that's
a
slight underestimate because I think the feet he was stacking were a little bit inflated by the overexposure. If you shrank those down or if you allowed for, say, 15 inches instead of 14.5 inches, that would bring you closer to the other more definitive more thoroughly investigated size estimate, which came out just a little over 7 feet. So we're only dealing with, you know, as you said, about 6 inches, but I think that can be reasonably accommodated by the different approaches and the assumptions that are made in each of those approaches.
Even though, again, though, if we're talking about 7'2" being the highest, that puts you in a rare category to find somebody who can fit, who would wear a 7'2" costume without it looking fakey, and as opposed to somebody who's 6'6", and much more common. In the end, you conclude that you believe the Patterson film is accurate.
I think based on the knowledge we have at hand, I think it is most likely, most probable that it is, in fact, an accurate representation of a living animal, yes.
What other than the Patterson film, which then would be great, but I mean, in terms of hard evidence, you have, you know, thousands of casts of Bigfoot feet and that sort of thing. What's the best physical evidence that exists for Bigfoot?
Well, I only have in the range of a couple of hundred casts, not thousands, but I would say that does yet still constitute the most compelling case. I mean, now, some will quibble that footprints are not hard evidence, it's trace evidence, and that's true. And so if we limit ourselves to just hard evidence, then all we have is hair and potentially some scat samples here and there that in the past, none right in our hands at the moment. The hair, I think, is really interesting, though, and I think that there will potentially be some new light shed on that as we recruit some academics to take a closer look at the hairs that have been collected to date. Dr. Henner Fehrenbach has taken the lead, and much of what I report in the book relies heavily upon his work to try to assemble and make sense of this growing sample, some 15 plus samples now of hair from various independent sources, which all defy identification, defy attribution to a known species, but yet consistently show this core of characteristics that seems to unite all these under a single umbrella. That is interesting. We're working towards getting these independently analyzed and corroborated, and I think that will go. You know, I'm not going to mention it right now who that is, just until we get this analysis done. But that will go a long way, I think, in clarifying one way or the other just what it is that we're dealing with here in these otherwise indeterminate hair samples.
Well, as you can tell, Dr. Jeff Meldrum takes his science seriously. He has resisted every attempt I've made to exaggerate for effect. So when I say thousands of foot casts, he's very clear, no, just hundreds. You got to like that in a scientist. He's not willing to he doesn't want to kite any of these numbers. Sasquatch, legend meets science. And I'll explore some comments made by previous Bigfoot guests coming up next. I'd love to hear Dr. Jeff Meldrum's response to that next. The book is Sasquatch on Coast to Coast AM. I bet you didn't know that, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, that John Landis, the director, had sort of an influence on the Patterson film discussion. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
He the guy who did Animal House and did American Werewolf in London, and he claimed, he was sort of the mouthpiece for, I guess, the story of that Hollywood special effects guy who, as Hollywood rumor had gone, had said, it was the creator of the costume that was used in the Patterson film.
Right, John Chambers, yes.
And all. That's right, John Chambers. And it was really John Landis that was telling the story about John Chambers.
That's who right, then, I remember that now.
Who later denied it, didn't he? Didn't he deny it to his grave that he had anything to do with it?
That's my understanding. Bobby Short, who has an electronic newsletter, a very good newsletter, had conducted an interview with him in the rest home where he was residing before his passing. And yes, to my understanding of the gist of that interview, he categorically denied it. He said he wished he was responsible. He let others think that he was, and although he, I don't think he actively perpetuated the rumor. But I mean, all you have to do is just stop and ask yourself. Look at the track record of John Chambers, and look at the Planet of the Apes. And if he was capable of pulling off something as was depicted in the Patterson-Gimlin film, why don't we see evidence of that in Planet of the Apes or in anything subsequent to that? Why would someone have those skills and then not exploit them in the film industry?
Well, Planet of the Apes was pretty good, but I take your point. I think I could understand why, if it was bringing him work, that people thought he was that good, why rock the boat?
Right, yeah, exactly.
But there have been other guests, and I don't have to go over them by name, but a couple of times I've been halfway through a show on Bigfoot, and then my BS detector's going off left and right, because it seems like some people make it sound so easy to see and or interact with a Bigfoot. There's some people who have claimed sightings into the dozens, or that there are places in the Northwest, well-known places where Bigfoot family groups or community groups can be seen gathering. Do you have any testimony on this that you find credible?
No, I don't. Not that I find credible. I was going to say that that yes, there have been those types of claims, and that you know, the red flag often goes up when someone lays claim to multiple encounters and multiple experiences, you know, that goes beyond the realm of reason and has nothing to corroborate that claim. Nothing to substantiate it, and all we have is their word. There are no pictures, there's no documentation of footprints or any other of the types of corroborating evidence that we look for that aid us in, that let us go beyond just a sole reliance on someone's verbal account.
Is there an area which somebody like yourself, who, again, professor at Idaho State University, somebody well-respected, somebody doing the hard science of the Sasquatch research, is there an area which is considered to be Bigfoot central?
Well, not really. I mean, we were actually, I've worked in the past with individuals who have utilized various techniques, including the GIS analysis that we alluded to earlier and so forth, to more systematically point to areas which, quite frankly, you know, you can almost just identify by looking at a map with a scatter of reports and correlating that with just even a cursory knowledge of the types of habitats, the amount of rainfall, you know, the potential for there being the resources that one might expect. I mean, and this is, that in itself is a really interesting angle, because we don't have Bigfoot appearing, at least credibly, in downtown Manhattan or in Central Park or in the Owyhee Desert of Idaho. We have them in areas of Idaho, for example, where there is the appropriate types of habitat and resources. There seems to be an ecological correlation with credible reports that have the types of corroborative evidence we've just mentioned, and so on. So, no, I don't know of, you know, any real hot spots other than those that, you know, when you look along the Cascade Range, the Olympic Peninsula, the coastal ranges, these areas where there are still rich habitats in sufficient extent that one might expect there to be the potential for a large animal like this to remain elusive and evasive of human.
Circling back to the beginning of our discussion where we were talking about the sighting, the Jacobs images, the series of stills that that fired off pretty regularly that were set up with an infrared camera, and I believe it was a motion detector, wasn't it, that started the shooting?
Most of those do have a passive IR sensor so that if a warm body moves through the cone of sensitivity, they go off, yes.
Okay. And so if we had an area where they were most likely to exist, it would seem like science would be able to muster enough money to put together, say, 1,000 cameras like that strategically placed around these areas where, and say, even in the Cascade Mountains, where sightings had occurred before and sightings most likely might occur again, were it not for the fact that Bigfoot would be occasionally, you know, suspicious of human scent, and put these up. I mean, put them up everywhere. Why not?
Well, it sounds easy, doesn't it? But you have not only the initial expenditure in the cameras themselves and the batteries and all the equipment, but then you have to have somebody, or in the case of thousands, if that were the situation, you have to have an entire crew of personnel to monitor and maintain and swap out batteries, swap out film. It is a labor-intensive intensive project. You know, I was talking, we had some great conversations, George Schaller and I, about this possibility. George wrote the foreword to my book and has now openly at least acknowledged the need for serious scientific consideration of this subject. He was using as a case in point one of his graduate students who was studying Asian cheetahs. And this student, a doctoral student, was doing this full time, had many cameras, not in the thousands, but probably in the hundreds, and it was a full time job. And he said if this student got one picture on one camera of one cheetah in a given season of field work, they counted themselves really fortunate. This animal was so elusive. And there you're in a much more open habitat, an animal that's more likely to be baitable, bringing them into a camera with a well-established protocol for baiting and so forth. And so if you transpose those difficulties over to, or challenges over here, I would never encourage a student to undertake a project, although George encouraged me that a student could conduct, say, a census of North American wildlife using these types of techniques, Northwestern wildlife, and this would be a reasonable approach. And I think that's true, except that if even a wisp of the notion got out that this student was actually interested in capturing a picture of Sasquatch and that the census was just a front for that objective, I mean, that would really be academic suicide for a beginning student. I think it would be very difficult to establish a career on that.
Why isn't it suicide for you? Why aren't you teaching somewhere at a junior high school by this point?
Well, because I have tenure, and this is one of the reasons for tenure, is that it affords a certain degree of intellectual freedom to pursue risky propositions or risky questions of science, so that even if my colleagues or even if my administrators don't think that this is a worthwhile project, if I'm going about it in a reasonable fashion, then I have some job security. And I think that, through my stick-to-itiveness on this subject and my unwillingness to back down and my efforts to try to apply rigor and objectivity to the question and stay away from, as much as is possible, the sensationalism that this subject often attracts, I've seen some change in attitudes. I mean, the book has been a tremendous tool in that respect. There have been many, many individuals who, once they've picked up the book, There was a great example here on campus, a fellow whose familiarity with the terrain around Idaho was something I wanted to tap into and become better acquainted with, but he was not inclined to broach this subject. And so I just went ahead on a whim and sent him a copy of the book, just gratis, and said, you know, hey, if you get a chance, crack the book and take a look. Well, a few weeks later, I got a phone call, and he says, you know, I wasn't even going to look at it. I just stuck it on the shelf. And he said, eventually, though, I opened it up, and then I couldn't put it down. And he said, when would you like to get together and talk about this?
Yeah.
I mean, it opened the door for me, an opportunity, and that's been the greatest thing, is it really has helped to elevate the discussion and create new opportunities for collaboration. I mean, people aren't coming out of the woodwork, and some of them aren't even coming out of the closet as far as their interest goes, but they're making contact with me, and behind the scenes, there are lots of academics that are very interested in this subject and really do want to see somebody at least go ahead with this type of research.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Jeff Meldrum. The book is Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. How many Sasquatch do you think are living right now in North America? You mentioned it's a small population.
Right. Well, it's really a tough question. I mean, and it really requires going out on a limb and making some serious assumptions. But just to give you a short answer, I think that there are very few. I think that if we're talking about the western United States, Pacific Western and Intermountain and Canada, I think that there could be as few as 500, and maybe, you know, somewhere between 500 to 1,000 or so. And I know people oftentimes have very decided opinions about what constitutes a viable population. We really don't have a lot of good data on a lot of species on what constitutes a viable population, a healthy gene pool. You know, there are a lot of factors that come into play, life history factors, you know, rates of reproduction and so on. And individual populations have quite varied genetic loads that they're carrying, that would cause inbreeding depression if they're numbers were restricted. But if you look at mountain gorillas, there's only about 500 of those in existence on a small mountain range. They have a much denser population in their given range than what we would expect for a Sasquatch with a very different social structure and different habitat regiment. But there's no obvious genetic depression in that population of gorillas, at least none that we're aware of at the moment, and they have a very, very limited number of individuals.
I'll go back to a previous thought just to say, interesting how, though, in the case of the Jacobs video images, that those shots were taken with a motion detector and an infrared camera and were found fairly quickly. You know, so maybe it's just a reminder that sometimes you can get lucky. And if there something passing by, you know, it should be... Even if it turns out to be some sort of bear with mange, that's a pretty lucky shot to get, even.
Yeah. Well, we've got piles of photographs of all sorts of wildlife and some really great shots of mountain lions and lynx and coyotes, ravens, deer, elk, bear galore. And so you're right. I mean, one would think that this would be the way to go about it. You know, there have been other animals, very rare animals in exotic regions of the world where this type of technique has been successful in documenting unusual and rarely seen animals. But it does take a lot of work. You know, I've talked to some of these people who do this, and, you know, they say most people don't have a realistic idea of how much work it takes to run these cameras and maintain them and get those, you know, those $64,000 shots that catch the headlines.
There's a Lincoln researcher that was working with photographs taken at Gettysburg, especially those stereo-optic images that were popular at the time of the Civil War. And I don't know if you saw recently in the newspaper, they found some which because of his diligence and his belief that if there were so many photographs being taken with those stereo optic cameras, that there must be one taken of Abraham Lincoln.
Hmm.
And he just kept looking and blowing up until he found them. He found three, it would appear, of images they never knew had previously existed, and they were already filed. I mean, they already were cataloged. It wasn't like he found them in an attic or something. And I think that's the kind of intriguing part, is maybe the conclusive photo of Bigfoot already exists. We just don't know where it is yet. Let's talk about sound a little bit. And a reminder, too, that we'll get to people's calls coming up next hour. But what's the best audio evidence yet of Bigfoot?
Well, there are a lot of recordings. And let me just preface this by saying that my answers to these varied questions are all qualified in that I'm not expert in all of these subjects. No one person can be. And so I rely heavily on the analyses and the statements of other people. There are lots of recordings that anyone can listen to if they just surf the web. I mean, the one that's the most extensive and that I still find very intriguing are referred to as the Sierra sounds that were taken down in California a number of decades ago. And there are just some interesting qualities to those recordings that still keep me coming back and listening to them and wondering about them. My only concern about that whole episode remains that the associated footprints are of an unusual nature, and the footprints don't sit comfortably with me as a good solid corroboration of the experiences that these individuals are having.
If you had to describe the characteristics of the scream, what would the characteristics of a Bigfoot sound be?
Well, there have been a variety of vocalizations described, and that would be expected if this is indeed a large primate. One of the types of vocalizations are these, as you mentioned, screams, these high-pitched sort of wailing cries that can have a tremendous volume and magnitude. These would probably be the types of vocalizations that the animals use when they're advertising their presence, trying to contact a conspecific that's separated by a great deal of distance. If as we suspect, these animals are very dispersed in their environment and rather solitary in their habits. There are also whistling type of a call, which may be a little more proximate, wouldn't carry as far, given the reduced volume and magnitude of those vocalizations.
Sure.
But and then Sierra sounds are quite intriguing because they seem to depict some, what I refer to as proximate vocalizations, where they're individuals interacting with one another.
I'll hang on to that thought. We'll come to that coming up in just a second. And your calls, all the numbers, next, Sasquatch on Coast to Coast AM. We're headed to our last hour with Dr. Jeff Meldrum from Idaho State University. Sasquatch Legend Meets Science is his book. His specialty is vertebrate locomotion. So it's a little outside of his wheelhouse to be talking about the vocalization of Bigfoot as it's been recorded. But you spent some time on it in the book, The Science of That. I think it was very interesting. And you were just talking about the part that you thought was most compelling in audio that you've heard captured is when it sounds as though there's a Bigfoot conversation taking place.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's one of the distinctive. I mean, most of the eyewitness accounts or most of the recordings that are captured are of these far-off large volume cries that are carrying some distance, and so it's not as often that a witness has an opportunity to record vocalizations that are right up close and personal. And the Sierra sounds at least presents the possibility that this may have occurred repeatedly at this particularly remote site in the Sierra Nevadas, and as such, it's really quite intriguing. It's in its uniqueness in that regard and in its revelation of what are strikingly ape-like exchanges in vocalization between multiple Sasquatch that were apparently there on the scene, but also the interaction between the witnesses and the Sasquatch. There was one exchange that I found particularly intriguing, and which actually led further into other aspects of the vocalizations. That was, there was an instance where one of the witnesses inside the shelter was calling out, and he whistled through his teeth, that kind of a whistle, and the Sasquatch attempted to respond and imitate, but there seemed to be a definite distinction in the quality of the sound. There was almost an added harmonic, as if the Sasquatch wasn't whistling through its teeth, but it was whistling in its throat with, you know, multiple points of constriction. And, you know, so this prompted a bit of speculative jaunt on my part, because there are humans that can create overtones or harmonics to their voice. The famous throat singers of Chuva, and there's other tribal groups in Siberia and the Beringia area that have traditional songs that they create this overtone deep down in their throat by constricting various structures like larynx or the pharynx, the muscular pharynx of the throat. It also raises the possibility, or got us thinking too, with encouragement from some bioacoustic analysts, that these animals may also be capable of producing infrasound. They, if they indeed are great apes, there's a very good chance that they would possess the plumbing, so to speak, for creating these infrasounds. Great apes, gorillas and orangs, especially chimpanzees to a lesser degree, have extra laryngeal air sacs that these projections are from above their larynx and sometimes below, that project off of the respiratory tract and create these sacs that go out under the skin or even the musculature in the neck, on the chest, down into the armpits. It's almost like having a built-in bagpipe.
Right. I like the illustration you had in the book on that. But I kept thinking about just even the simple thing that almost anybody can do, and that's just hum while you're whistling.
Right. You're true. Yeah.
I mean, it's just
exactly.
How else do you describe a UFO landing, you know, without being able to do that?
And in that respect, you're using different parts of your mouth to make different sets of tones that create that overtone sound. It's an interesting possibility. But infrasound poses this really fascinating possibility of a means of vocalization, a means of communication between widely dispersed individuals in a very broken and densely vegetated habitat, because the infrasound will carry much, much further than will regular vocalizations.
It might explain why the Bigfoot are climbing trees.
Well, that could be too. Yeah, mm-hmm. To get out of the impedance of the forest canopy. Absolutely.
If they're making that noise, make it from the broadcast. They're climbing the broadcast tower, as it were, to reaching out through Radio Bigfoot to whoever is within the sound of their voice. Well, much like we're going to do next, we'll take the calls and we'll get everybody on for Dr. Jeff Meldrum on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. East of the Rockies, we'll start with John in Ohio, triumphant today over Michigan. Here's Sasquatch author Dr. Jeff Meldrum. John?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I got two quick questions. I'm trying to plug in the timeline of the history of Sasquatch in with the, what scientists pretty much agree was a great flood. How would Sasquatch have survived the Great Flood? And the second question is, as far as infrared or thermal scanning in the wintertime, your bears would be hibernating. Would that be useful in detecting Sasquatch?
Well, first, I'm not sure what you mean by scientific recognition of a Great Flood. As far as I know, there have been recognitions of some local events here and there. But
yeah, it's my understanding that anywhere on the planet they can get sedimentary layers that indicate that the world was covered in water.
Well, but not all at one time, and on over great by sampling over great spans of time. I mean, sedimentary rocks are that they're laid down almost exclusively by water action. But if you're getting at whether Sasquatch was on the ark or not, I'm not really in a position to comment on that or to speculate one way or the other.
Well, let's put a time on that, to Jeff and John. If we're talking about that flood, then science says roughly 6,000 or so years ago, that region of the world in that basin, in that part, say, between northern Africa all the way up to Asia Minor and southern Europe, that there may have been a massive flooding of that area, but that still wouldn't really apply necessarily to Sasquatch because that area I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that that flood covered the entire world, but scientifically speaking.
Right, exactly. So, okay. But your other question is very interesting, and it depends on just what the yearly habits of Sasquatch might be. We don't know, for example, if they hibernate or if they estivate or have periods of inactivity. So, while bear are denned up and hibernating, we don't know if Sasquatches are doing the same thing or are moving to lower elevations where the climate is a little less severe and they're able to find sufficient resources to get them through the winter. So thermal imaging certainly would have applications, but again, it's even in wintertime, it's still that proverbial needle in a haystack, and it's the ongoing challenge of funding and resources. It wouldn't be cheap to. I mean, the only way to do that effectively would to be to survey from the air, and then you've got all of the expenses and man hours that are involved in that type of a survey. So at present, there's just not. I mean, I have due to the very good graces of some benefactors who wish to see at least some research marching forward. I have some modest resources to keep in the field for short periods of time on an annual basis, but there is no systematic search going on. There are a lot of very enthusiastic and in many instances very talented amateur field workers, or not, you know, non-professional, in that they're not getting paid to do this as a day job, but there are no ongoing academic systematic field studies being conducted at this point.
Well, if you ever are serious about trying to do more, and you're looking for a stream of revenue for that, I think somebody with your credentials could come on a show like Coast to Coast and say, "Look, I can't guarantee anything, you can't come with me, but, you know, here's a 1-800 number, and see whether you couldn't get 1,000 people to donate $25 toward this, because if that would finance a specific mission." I think you might be surprised at how some of that funding could come about. Don't know if that would help or not, but just a thought. Let's go west of the Rockies. Steven is on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Steven?
Yes, good morning, Ian. Good morning, Dr. Meldrum. I was just wondering, I have a comment and then a question. Basically, I was just wondering, you know how there have been reports by the Bigfoot investigators saying that the Sasquatch has a keen sense of smell, that usually if you're downwind from them, they avoid you. Mm-hmm. And just like when you have a bloodhound going out and looking for either a fox or even for a crime scene investigation, you have a dog that's going out and they pick up the scent from an article of a person that's missing. I was just wondering, and this is my question, how much care is being taken to sanitize the camera equipment, the tripod, and everything in the area, you know, footsteps or whatever, to the scene to prevent, you know, the Sasquatch from picking up a scent from a human, thus avoiding the area completely?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Now listen up here.
It is.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, if Sasquatch is a primate, its sense of smell probably isn't anywhere near as keen as that of a bloodhound or, you know, canine of any type, or even some of the other, canid-related animals like bears, ursids, and so forth. But obviously their sense of smell would probably be better attuned than ours is, because we just simply don't rely on it very much in our situations in society. We do, when we're in the field, we do go to pains to try to mask our scent when using baits and camera traps and so forth. And one of the ideas with the baits is, you know, is also to help augment that by making a scent that's much more attractive, and perhaps if there is any lingering human scent, it'll still draw something in. Again, it's just a matter. It's been more a matter of the opportunity to work out in the field and utilize these resources in under optimal conditions,
right.
Or than it is. You know, we just have not had a lot of opportunity to work out all the potential foreseeable kinks in these types of protocols in the field.
First time caller line, Nick is in West Virginia on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Nick?
Good morning, gentlemen. How you doing?
It's fine, thank you.
I live in effectively on the Mason-Dixon line, right below Greene County, where it hits Monongalia. There's been some little titterings back and forth about a place in Pennsylvania which is highly deciduized, if I can use that word. There's still a lot of woods left.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't logged it all out. So I was wondering, there's even a road called Bigfoot Road up there.
Hmm.
Because there's been a lot of activity.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you'd heard anything about that.
Not specifically that area.
Greene County, right on the corner of where West Virginia hits up into Pennsylvania.
Go ahead. I've driven through that area. Go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah. Well, there certainly are reports that have come out of the eastern United States and the areas down the backside, particularly of the Appalachia and down into the deep south, certainly have relative remoteness, relative lack of development, and so forth, that would make those realistic possibilities. As I said earlier, I've only recently had the luxury of time to devote a little bit of attention to some of those areas. I have visited a site out along the eastern mountain ranges and have witnessed some interesting possible evidence, but I'm not as familiar with the evidence that's out there. I've always been a little bit hesitant because there doesn't seem to be the body of footprint data to corroborate the many reports and sightings that have come out of those regions. There have been some exceptions to that, but by comparison to the sample that I'm working with from the Pacific Northwest and the mountain states, I mean, it just pales. And that I've always found is curious. I don't know what would be so different about the circumstances or the soil. And in fact, you would think there would be more cultivated land that would be adjacent to these areas that might lend itself more, even more, to footprint finds. And yet we don't. We don't seem to see that. In fact, some of the significant amount of the footprint evidence that I have seen from the east it bears remarkable resemblance to a human footprint, and I'd be hard-pressed to distinguish them from human footprints in either size or shape. There's still a lot we don't know about the mid-range sizes of human or of Sasquatch footprints. And so I wouldn't just say offhandedly that these tracks are without a doubt human, but at this point, I have no basis to reject that more conservative conclusion that they just are misplaced human footprints.
Wildcard Line, Thelma is in Indiana on Coast to Coast AM for the author of Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. Go ahead, Thelma.
Yes, sir. I have had a personal experience with Sasquatch. As a matter of fact, it was a family of them. And I used to live in a town called Brownsville, Kentucky. And every morning we would have a gigantic footprint in our yard, or in the front yard. And I had a boyfriend who was 6'5", and the footprint was twice the size of his foot. And we had, like, a waterfall, and down below the house, there was a lake with a bunch of wooded trees. And me and my family and some friends, you know, decided to go down and find out, you know, what was down there. And we looked up, and there was a family of these Sasquatch around us. And we quickly got out of there. And when the I had been asked about it before or afterwards, where this person could find Sasquatch, and I would show them, and I said, I will never go down there. And when the person returned up, I said, well, did you find anything? And he would turn white as a ghost.
Well, I want to get to Dr. Meldrum's response to that coming up in just a minute, but let me just say to you, Thelma, you could be doing the whole world, in particular hard science, a big favor next time if you would allow yourself to be attacked and or eaten, because then we'd have something, okay? Or bring a camera if you go down there again, and we'll talk about that then. The best testimony, we'll get Dr. Meldrum's response to that, and then ask him, what's the best eyewitness story where he finds most credible of the appearance of a Bigfoot? Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science next, and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We were just talking with Thelma there before the bottom of the hour, and Dr. Jeff Meldrum was about to speak on that subject. She said she saw a family group of them at one point, up close and personal. Where are you with that? And with my other question of, what is the best eyewitness testimony you've ever heard for a Bigfoot? And is it in the book Sasquatch Legend Meets Science?
Well, if she has indeed witnessed footprints on a regular basis, I would hope that after the initial shock had faded, that she did snap some snapshots, some photographs of those footprints, which I would very much like to have a look at if she has those. And similarly, if there is evidence of persistent presence of something down in this area that she has indicated, and others have witnessed that as well, it would sure seem logical that someone could just walk down there with a camera in hand and get something, and that'd be a great breakthrough if that's achieved.
But if it's not her, then who? Who's the best?
I'm sure that amongst your listeners, there's a lot of people in it was Indiana, right?
Yeah, for her.
That would be available to help her out with that. I mean, there's lots of people,
right,
with camcorders, lots of people even in that area,
sure,
that I'm aware of, that have interest and could do that, yeah.
But I mean, the people you've spoken with, who you've interviewed personally, who've reached out to you to say, look, I don't have a picture, I don't have an audio recording, here's what happened to me, and they happen to be, you know, a geologist, or they happen to be somebody that, you know, that comes to you with some credibility on the subject.
Right.
What's the best you've ever heard?
Well, when I'm asked that question, the one witness that comes to mind repeatedly is someone that I've gotten to know, and so I do trust her recollection and her interpretation, her perceptions of her experience. It was a story that got some publicity when it was publicized in the Denver Post, and that's Julie Davis. She's been a very good, hardworking field worker on some of our projects. She was goat packing and trekking along the Continental Divide Trail in southern Colorado She had a couple of pack goats and a couple of dogs with her. And basically she had gone off trail to get a little more seclusion. The dogs had acted a little bit agitated, as if there might be a bear or something in the area. And so she was on her, being watchful, careful, as you always should under those circumstances. After setting up camp, there was a point at which the dogs were looking at the tree line. She was in a meadow. And she didn't want the dogs, obviously, to tangle with a bear, and if one did come into the meadow. And she put the dogs in the tent, grabbed her pepper spray, and as she went to step out, the goats had also come up close to the tent, and she stepped out ready to confront a bear, possibly, and instead, standing behind her tent was a large Sasquatch, gazing down at her and at her goats, and her description of that experience, her detailed description of what she witnessed and its behavior, it basically just looked upon her and upon her goats, which it probably found as an oddity, and then turned and walked off into the woods. But very credible, very unembellished, very believable, her descriptions of the facial features and its behavior, its movements, its gait and so forth were very interesting. And
do you put it to a lie detector test?
No, I mean, I'm not in the business of doing that. You know, as far as okay. I'm concerned, the eyewitness accounts are just stories to a large degree. You know, I was accosted one time by one of my colleagues who said, "Well, after all, Jeff, these are just stories." But many of the stories, and if that were the case, this would be a very different endeavor for me, and I probably wouldn't have ever embarked on it. My retort was, well, just stories that leave footprints, that shed hair, that void scat, that are seen by many people, incredible people. But the eyewitness accounts at this stage don't do us a whole lot of good, other than one, we can do these types of studies that try to look for patterns in the encounters and, more importantly, the association of the encounters with various resource factors, habitat factors, and so forth. Two, if the observers are observant and careful of detail, we might learn something about the anatomy. We might learn something about the behavior that a new sighting indicates. And three, as you pointed out, clearly the credentials, the title of the individual has some bearing. I mean, people do take the testimony of a trained observer, a game warden, a wildlife biologist, a professional scientist in the field, such as a geologist, give more weight to that type of an account. Someone who is then willing to stake their reputation on what it was that they saw. And so that does lend some credibility. I mean, I certainly do sit up when a professional, an agency personnel or something like that, someone like that is willing to come forward with a story and share their experience. But otherwise, unless there is, as in the case of Thelma's account, I mean, she has potentially a footprint,
right,
but hopefully more than one, to corroborate her experience. And then although I can't do a whole lot to objectively scrutinize her rendering of her visual sighting of a family of Sasquatch, I can look at the footprint that she takes a picture of or makes a cast of in her front yard. And with some degree of objectivity and certitude can determine what the likelihood is that this is just a misidentification or
right,
a hoax or maybe something else.
Well, let's see who else comes forward in the time we have left on the phones next for Dr. Jeff Meldrum on Coast to Coast AM. Wildcard line, Dan is in Detroit for Dr. Jeff Meldrum on Coast to Coast AM. Dan?
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you.
Dr. Meldrum, myself and another gentleman witnessed a Bigfoot on Camp Pendleton within 25 feet. This was in 1983. If you look at the base, you'll see Vandegrift Boulevard runs in from the main gate, so about 8 miles to the airstrip area. which is Area 24, and the Santa Margarita River runs along it. Myself and another gentleman were on guard duty on the armory, which is about 100 yards long, and we were in front. We weren't walking our posts like we should have been, but we were in front of the armory, and at that time, we heard a very loud, shrill shriek. Now, we thought it was a woman because that road, normally people jog that road or ride bikes on it. So we ran to the back of the armory. Now, it drops. It's an asphalt parking lot that drops about 2.5 to 3 feet down into a boggy, wooded area, and then it goes up to the side of a mountain. We were in the back of the armory. We had our flashlights, and we were shining into the woods. And at the same time, our beams crossed, and we saw at eye level a big, well, it was, to me, it was a Bigfoot. I believe it to this day. It was probably about 7 to 7.5 feet tall, dark brown to black, had dark eyes staring right at us, a head that was conical, but not to a point, a rounded conical head, had facial features. He was staring right at us. We saw it for an instant when our beams crossed. I looked at Doug next to me. I said, "Did you see what I see?" He said, "Yes." We shined it back to the woods. There was nothing there. Well, being Marines, we had shotguns at the time. We were carrying shotguns. He started to go down the gravel path, and at that time, we heard a loud snap, and we heard it running through the, like, cattails. Well, we shined the light into the cattails, and we saw a swath that was cut right through and a branch about 3 inches across that was broken off a tree. We went into the armory. There was a gentleman working in the armory at the time, and this was all documented on the base because the officer of the day showed up at that time. They took photographs. It wasn't a muddy area. It was grassy and boggy, so it actually left imprints on the grass, but they brought out one of those lights that you see going downstairs, those fire spotlights that go on when there's a fire, and we lit up the whole area, and there was a swath probably about 6 feet wide that was just trampled down through grass. They took footprints of it. I believe one of the universities, I think it was Cal State Fullerton, came down to take footprints. These footprints were probably 20 inches long at least, and they left about an inch and a half depression in the grass. And they saw, now myself and another gentleman saw it, but for approximately about a week to week and a half, they had sightings of it around that armory area. And if you go on a base map and see where the armory is, you'll see it's where the 24 area is kind of remote. But to this day, I can describe that story like it was yesterday. And I'm 44 years old, and that happened in 1983, and I'll never forget it.
Dr. Meldrum?
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, that really is fascinating. Did you follow up on those? My interest is focused on the footprints for the moment. But did you follow up on those casts? Would you be able to provide any contact?
Well, I was asked, since you're a professor, you might be able to have access, because what they did to us, the guard chief showed up. There were about 6-7 Marines showed up because we had intercoms. They came down to the armory area. There were 6 different posts. And the officer of the day, which was a captain, he showed up. And obviously, you know, everyone's laughing at you when we tell them what we saw. Well, when he showed up, he took it seriously because we pointed out. And once he saw the impressions into the grass, he was the one that ordered a report done. They took us separately into each room in the guard shack, and they told us to describe what we saw, and it was identical. Myself and Doug described the exact same thing. We even volunteered to have lie detector tests, and they said that's not necessary. We described what we saw, we drew what we saw, and they recorded it. He made a report to the Marine Air Group chief. And as far as I know, I mean, I was only a corporal at the time, so they're not going to give information to me. But I remember for the next week or so, because everyone could hear everyone else's intercom,
sure,
on walkie-talkies, I was on different posts. One guy was on that post by himself, and he was actually walking that post. It was a dock where expediter trucks parked along, because it was an armory, and there was a tall hill about maybe 5 to 6 stories high on the one side of the parking lot. And something was throwing, like, dirt rocks down on the trucks and on him. And he saw a large figure. He also reported a large figure on top of the hill.
Well, hang on. Here's what I want to do, Dan. I want to put you on hold before we lose you. And I want you to give your number to Gina.
Okay.
And then Dr. Meldrum, if you want Dan's number. I think that certainly ranks there as somebody worth maybe pursuing for some of your research. So we'll just let you make that decision. And, Dan, absolutely, hang on. We'll get your number.
Sure.
Wildcard line, George is in Utah on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Jeff Meldrum. George?
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. I'm a Pocatello, Idaho resident, and I wanted to relate a story about something that I, not something that I saw, but something that I heard 30 years ago hunting with my dad and one of our hunting partners. This was in a remote corner of southeast Idaho, out in the Grace area. And it was an area that was really far off the beaten path. Today it's a little different. There are some roads in this area. But first let me say a couple things about the guys that I was hunting with so that I can kind of add some credibility to the circumstances. And
well, George, we're kind of tight on time. So I think we'll just stipulate that these are people that you had respect in and were credible
right,
enough.
The guys that I were with were... We're very avid hunters.
And, okay. So what happened?
Of course, familiar with any kind of sound that any kind of animal might make out in the wild. And we got into an area back there. And
sounds like we lost you. And I'm...
Oh, yeah.
Sorry about that. We were both very much enjoying that story. But Wildcard Line, Steve is in Seattle on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Steve?
Yeah, copy?
Yeah, we hear you great.
Yeah, I'm not looking for any more evidence. I was hoping that we might get some Sasquatch repellent up there around Mount Rainier.
You get a lot of them up there.
Yeah, my family members have seen them. We've had encounters with them, and I made a little list here for the doctor of things that we found that they do and how they travel. They travel in the riverbeds, and they go up ditches, and not so much now, but like 30 years ago, they were like coyotes. They were coming in, and they were stealing my grandmother's chickens, and they get down on their knees, and they hide out, you know. Nowadays, they're up more because of the logging, and they're in small groups. We found them in small groups. I found they bend over trees where some of the places where they live, like in riverbeds, about 9 inches around diameter. They'll take the trees. They're about 40 feet deep or tall, and they'll bend them over. Like if you bent over a straw, and you bent like a quarter of the straw was straight up, and the rest is all over like a lean-to. Now, we found those when we were kids, and there was actually a couple in there when my buddies were going in there. But anyways.
Well, Dr. Meldrum, what would you want to ask Steve?
Well, again, I mean, these are all types of things that pop up repeatedly and seem to be very consistent in parts of the behavior. I would just admonish these people, especially if they're having repeated experiences like this, to document them as best they can with what
photographs.
They have. Yeah.
Bring their cell phone cameras.
Exactly. Yeah.
And some sort of disposable cameras is something that they can get anything on if they're going to have these encounters enough. Never go out unarmed.
Right.
With a camera. Okay.
Yeah.
Steve, make sure you get it. Get it to us, and you know, whether it's a digital or something, we want to see it. International Line, George is in Alberta on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Jeff Meldrum. George?
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say very quickly, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to let you know that I almost feel as though I owe it to Mr. Patterson to back up the person. In 1968, I actually wrote him a letter. I believe it was September and October of that year. I got a letter back from him. And I remember clearly what reading the letter at that time and how believable it came through in the letter. He basically just, I believe it was 2 pages that I got back handwritten, and it was just incredible how he came through as being so truthful and so honest in the letter.
Well, that's great. Thank you, George. And no doubt that was certainly the impression of people who knew him, and it's an interesting version of that story of the book. Do we have time for one more? We'll try one real quickly. East of the Rockies, Bill is in Connecticut for Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Bill?
How you doing, Ian? And
got to be very quick here, Bill. Go ahead.
Jeff, I really enjoyed watching you on Monster Quest on Sasquatch Attack.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was going to ask you, are you currently investigating any sightings in the U.S.?
Well, as I said, I usually don't follow up directly on reported sightings like as such, unless there is corroborative evidence. Excuse me.
So get your corroborative evidence so we can get Dr. Jeff Meldrum back out into the field. The book is Sasquatch: Legend Meets Science, and I've just enjoyed it. That's just a terrific book. Again, great for a holiday gift giving. Interesting material, done so well. And that lends to credibility in every chapter. So thank you for your time, and look forward to being able to continue this conversation sometime in the future when we do have more evidence to put to the scientific test. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with the book, Sasquatch. In the meantime, Deus Tiamat, and I do too.